Yeah, well, hello everybody. Good to see you tonight. Firstly, an apology before I start, and that is I dreamt up the grand title, The World of Christ and First Century Christianity, and realised after I'd been going for a while that actually the subject taking all of that was just too much. I mean, just too vast, really. So I then thought, well, I'll reduce it and maybe take up to the crucifixion, and then maybe go on with the church in Palestine up to maybe AD 70 or something like that. But then I found, when you think about it, the church of the Gentiles and the church of the Jewish church, if you like, which anyway are intertwined, by the way, I couldn't really do one without the other. So, in fact, I've restricted it to the world of Christ for the moment. If you like this one, then I will with pleasure come back and think about beyond the crucifixion to the growth of the church, both in Palestine area and, of course, in the Gentile areas around the empire. And the situation actually is so different in that period that it warrants a completely separate subject anyway. So apologies for that. So we're really going to focus on the world of Christ and stay pretty much with that. Now, we've got this first slide, which looks like it goes all over the place, which it does. When I was at school, one of the things we had to do, being a good old English public school, you know, and all that stuff, we had to learn classical history. And for my sins, that and Latin, of course, and all these other useless things, or they seem useless today. But it's interesting how, just in a sentence this is going to be, because I want to get down to near the end of it, but it's interesting how Israel sits at what was the main part of the empires in that century, well, 1,000 years, the millennium, between 1000 BC and zero, if you like. You've got the reign of David to start. The Assyrian Empire came into being. And many of you will remember that the kingdoms separated after Solomon, and the northern kingdom disappeared in 722-21 to the Assyrian Empire. And the southern kingdom, Judah and Benjamin, lasted that bit longer. That's because the Assyrian Empire was getting weak, and they fell to the Babylonian Empire a bit earlier than 575, where they started deporting about 589 or something like that. And then they started filtering back during the 500s, Nehemiah, Ezra, and all of those. And then, of course, Alexander the Great conquers Palestine in 332. He died quite soon after that, in the 320s, and his empire got split between the Ptolemy family, however you pronounce it, and they dominated Egypt and Palestine, and the Antiochus family, and they dominated Syria. And so it rumbled on for 100 years or two, and then Antiochus nicked Palestine. And Antiochus the Fourth is the one called Antiochus Epiphanes. And if you remember your Old Testament history, you'll remember how he went into the temple and sacrificed to Zeus, the abomination of desolation of Daniel, and all of that stuff. That was how they read it at the time. Of course, Jesus took it again a bit later on, as you will know, in a way warning the Christians to get out of Jerusalem, which was, of course, fulfilled some 30 or 40 years later in the Jewish War of 66 to 70, when the Christians had ample time, as we shall see maybe later, to get out of Jerusalem before the destruction really came. So Antiochus sacrifice, and that was the bleak day in Jewish history. They always remember that. For 3 years, pagan sacrifices took place in the temple. And then you've got the Maccabean revolt. Maccabeus means the hammer. Judas the Hammer. He was one of five brothers, and he rebelled against Antiochus and the Seleucid part of the empire, as it was called. And they were weakening. So again, the old story of empires grow and then they weaken. And that enabled the brothers to go on fighting. And Simon, who was the last of the five brothers, they'd all died in warfare, routs the forces of Antiochus in 143. And then declares independence in 142, I think it was, which isn't there. And this is the important point I want to make. And if you remember nothing else out of this lot, and you probably won't, the important point is, and people generally forget, and I've heard it in sermons wrongly, that from 134 down to 63, 142 down to 63, the Jewish nation was independent. Now that's a terribly important point. It affects their whole, clouds their whole attitude to the Roman Empire and the desire for Messiah to come and free them. They'd had a taste of freedom for about 80 years. Now, previous to that, as you can see all the way down here, they were basically under the rule of other empires. They hadn't had serious freedom for, well, 600-700 years. That bit's true. But they did have 80 years of freedom down to the Roman general Pompey, who we'll come to again in a while, actually coming and taking Jerusalem. It would be wrong to say that the Jewish people lived in great peace with one another. It's an appalling time. The rule of these different people was generally at the expense of endless other people they'd killed off to get there. I mean, don't let's, you know, think this was a peaceful land and some families ruled and everybody was peace, joy and happiness. That was far from the truth. And indeed, there was open warfare between 67 and 63. So when Pompey arrived, who would in any way have wiped out any opposition, he was probably one of the best of Roman generals of all time. They were so busy fighting each other, they hardly noticed that he'd got there. In fact, he also went into the temple, by the way. But I don't think his was an abomination in the sense that Antiochus had. He was just curious to know what was in there. So he went into the Holy of Holies, and of course, the place is empty, as you know, and so that was his curiosity satisfied, as it were. But that was 63 BC. Okay, I think that's all I'm going to say about that one. That's one sheet of paper I can lose. That's a good start, isn't it? Can we go on to the next one? Right, this takes us on a little further. Much further, in fact. In fact, can we just go on from there and find the map one? On again, that's only that now. This is the interesting bit. The previous empires, the Assyrian, the Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, they all look much the same. Different colours on the map, but broadly covered the same area. They simply absorbed each other. One or two variations. The Greek Empire took all this area. As you can see, the bits that are marked. What you notice about the Roman Empire is that it's pretty much different. And that's quite important because the two empires grew together. The Roman Empire was growing at the same time as the Greek Empire was actually in existence and declining. And of course, eventually the Roman Empire took a lot of the Greek Empire. Okay, can we go back to the... Sorry, David. Can we go back to the other one again now? No. That's it. No, it's not. Back again. That's it. That's the one. Yeah.
The next one is the same as that.
It's the same one. Yeah, it just makes it bigger. But actually...
Move on one more. It's bigger. Yeah.
Yeah, you've got it a bit bigger. The bit that went underneath has come out of the side. We actually, for obvious reasons, we don't actually need all that because we're really only going to look at the first part. After 63, again, ever so brief, but you need the background to a bit of this. You've got the reign of Pompey and Caesar. Pompey did his major work in this eastern side of the Mediterranean. Turkey as we know it today, Greece and those areas, mopping them up on behalf of the Roman Empire. Caesar was, of course, if you remember, if you ever did any of his Gallic Wars and all that stuff, was very much over the other side, Germany, France, Spain, Britain briefly, didn't bring enough army with him, so he never took Britain. That was left till about 50 AD, in fact, outside our thinking. But he worked in that side, and between them, they consolidated the empire hugely. Pompey died a bit later. Caesar, of course, you remember your history, Shakespeare and all that, the Ides of March, Cassius and Brutus. Warfare then broke out hugely. Caesar Augustus, he of the Christmas story, the decree went out and all that, his name was Octavian, and he was Caesar's great nephew and his heir. That's quite important. And he and Mark Antony waged war against Brutus and Cassius, defeated them. By that time, however, Pompey had become friendly with the folk who lived in Egypt, of course, and all of that. And he became quite a danger as far as the empire was concerned. And eventually they went to war as well. And eventually Augustus wins and he becomes sole ruler of the Roman Empire. He'd become friendly with Herod, Herod the Great as we know him. And the Roman Empire was always quite keen to have especially states on the edge of the empire, and don't forget they were right on the edge of the empire, have rulers in there who could look after the place, raise their own army, which is quite important, and generally do the policing for them. And the Roman policy was, if the ruler was doing a good job, you left him in place. There wasn't this idea that you swept everybody out and replaced them with someone else. And so Herod was there, and he was recognized as king of the Jews, and he reigned, as you can see, down to 4 or 2. Most people accept 4, so we'll run with that. Meanwhile, of course, Augustus had wiped out all his enemies, as you would expect, and they had literally gone. And he was left, as I say, as sole ruler at that time. Enough of that then. The key thing to remember then is that when Herod the Great died, and we look at some of the Bible stories in a moment, when he finally died in 4 BC, his kingdom was divided. He bequeathed it to 3 of his sons. Herod the Great was a brutal ruler. In order to retain the throne without any threat, he murdered at least, the score is about 20 of his relatives, 2 of his sons, his parents-in-law, his wife, or one of them. It went on and on and on. At least 20 of his relatives perished during his time. He started building the temple, of course, and did a lot of other building work, but he was a brutal sort of ruler. And so when he went, he bequeathed the kingdom to his sons. It was divided up, come to that in a moment. They went off to Rome to establish their claim, because, of course, Herod only ruled because Rome allowed him to. And so the 3 of them had to march off to Rome. Open rebellion opened out while they were away. It was carnage everywhere. And eventually, the 3 sons were confirmed in different kingdoms and roles. And you've got Archelaus, who got Judea and Samaria, basically. Herod Antipas, the Herod of the other Herod we see of in the Gospels. He reigned from 4 down to AD 39. Eventually he was deposed, and he had Galilee and the other areas around there. And Philip, who had the areas, we'll see in a moment when we get there, the other side of the Sea of Galilee and north of that. And he reigned from 4 right through to 34. He was the only one of those three to survive as ruler as long as he lived. The others got deposed. Archelaus was so bad a ruler, the worst of the sons, that by AD 6, the Jewish community in Judea were so horrified that they sent a deputation to Rome to see Augustus, and he summoned Archelaus, who was exiled somewhere to Gaul, I think, somewhere well out of the way. And the province of Judea was turned over to prefects and procurators. In other words, it was ruled directly. And that's quite important. And it was the only one of the three that was at any time in our period that we're going up to, just the crucifixion of Jesus. It was the only one that was ruled directly by Rome. Now, whether the Jews were any better off is quite another question. Probably not. But anyway, they made their appeal and Augustus did with it. So from AD 6, Judea and Samaria are ruled over by a Roman procurator or prefect. In fact, we always thought that Pontius Pilate, for example, who's the most well-known of those for obvious reasons, was a procurator. In fact, it turns out from modern archaeology he was a prefect. There isn't a lot of difference. He still had to raise his own forces and raise his own army and govern as under Rome. If he got into big difficulties, he could appeal to the legate of Syria, just further up along the coast, and get some help from there. But broadly, he had to look after the place himself and provide his own forces. That will have some bearing, and we'll see later on. The important thing to remember, and again, if you remember nothing else about this bit of blurb, the important thing to remember is they were three different countries. That's quite important as we get to the gospel story. You went over the border from one to the other. It was a bit like the EU today. You didn't need a passport or anything else. And you could trade and people move freely. That was part of the Roman peace that came with Augustus in 31 and on. There was peace largely over the Roman Empire. You could move freely between any countries. That will have particular bearing later on with Paul and Peter and the other apostles as they seek to move around what was then the Roman Empire. It was easy. Well, it wasn't easy. It was probably jolly hard. But it was easy in the sense that you could do it and no one hindered you in any way and trade moved freely and so on. So it's important to remember you're in three different countries and that certainly will have a bearing as we go on. Pontius Pilate was the fifth prefect. Augustus kept changing them. Tiberius, who came after, who was Augustus's adopted son, both Augustus's sons perished for different reasons, he didn't bother so much. So Pontius Pilate was in post. Augustus tended to let them do 2 or 3 years, and before they became too corrupt, he tended to replace them. Tiberius didn't always bother, so Pontius Pilate had a really long stretch, probably the longest of any of them. He was not a good ruler. He very deliberately antagonized the Jewish people in all sorts of ways. He brought the standards of the legions into Jerusalem. And they were blessed to foreign deities. And it had already been decreed by Rome that, the Jews had sensibilities, so they had to leave their standards outside. Roman legions hardly ever came in to Jerusalem anyway. But that was what had to happen. And he deliberately brought standards in and did all sorts of things to antagonize. And eventually there were complaints about him for a whole variety of reasons. And he got replaced and exiled. In fact, but he's the one we know about because he was the one at the time of Jesus' crucifixion, of course. Okay, let me just see where I am. I've been wibbling on and ignoring these notes. Yes, I've left out a fair bit. A lot has been asked about the Roman Empire and its motivation. Why did they construct that empire that went all round? Well, originally, of course, they didn't. Rome started off in about 700 BC, and they slowly absorbed all of Italy. But Carthage, over in North Africa, had Sicily, Sardinia, Corsica, and Spain, really close to Italy. And it was inevitable they would come to war. And indeed they did. And eventually, it took a century, or even longer, eventually Rome came out at the top of it. Meanwhile, the remainder of the Greek Empire had allied with them. And so many of the Greek states had already allied themselves to Rome. So Rome was then in the invidious position of, when they were threatened, of having to come to their aid. And much of the other side of the Mediterranean, Turkey and Greece, came into Roman hands because they were committed by treaty to their friends there to come and rescue them in times of trouble. And that was what Pompey was doing when he arrived in Jerusalem in 63 BC. But what motivated them, I wonder? Well, it's easy to tie up history in neat little bundles. If any of you watch David Starkey's programs on television, his history programs, you don't? Yes, he's quite good. I like watching some of them. But history is all very neat and tidy and done up in little packets for you. And history is never quite like that. So although the Romans, yes, they did want to expand, a lot of it came because they went to the help of their friends. And they realized, Caesar and Pompey, that unless they had the whole of the Mediterranean border, they could not really service it unless they had the sea. And the Mediterranean, Mare Nostrum, our sea. That's what they called it, our sea, Mare Nostrum. And they were able then to use the sea, clear it of pirates, keep a couple of fleets so they could keep it clear of pirates, and as well as the roads, they could communicate. I think they saw that they had to surround the Mediterranean. The army, of course, was quite large. They had 25 legions, somewhere near a quarter of a million men under arms. And many of the history books tell you that was an enormous army, and unnecessary. But when you consider that the boundary of the empire all the way around was nearly 10,000 miles, it actually wasn't that much of an army, not when they were at war on the boundaries. And most of the army was kept on the boundaries of the empire. There was almost no Roman army anywhere in the main provinces, which most people forget. When you watch Ben-Hur, if you haven't for a few years, the concept of Roman legion soldiers stamping everywhere with their big boots is actually a fiction. There weren't any. Certainly not in Judea, and certainly not at this time. Pontius Pilate and the previous folk and Herod, they all had to raise their own army. There would have been no legions up in Syria, maybe, to be called upon in a crisis. But neither Herod nor the procurators would want to call in any crisis, because it looked like they'd failed. So that they didn't. The only time the legions intervened, once Archelaus and these folk were established in their kingdoms, well, they weren't called kings, they were just rulers. Once they were established, no Roman legions, I don't think, entered the Promised Land until, you know, the Great Rebellion later on in the 60s. But so there's a bit of a fiction there. Okay, so let's go on. Galatians 4:6 reminds us that when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son. And God chose the moment. There was this 100 years of general peace between 30 BC and about 70 AD, when the Caesar family and all these emperors were related. They were part what's called the family of Caesar. Generally, except when Nero went off his pins towards the end of his time, there was peace that prevailed. And so God chose his moment for Jesus to be born when that fullness of time. There was peace, There was a general level of prosperity. There was an openness of borders and all the things that we have mentioned. Okay, what I want to do, if I may, is maybe launch into a few of the stories. You know, I'm always impressed by the birth of Jesus. I expect you are too. It's a pity that the stories that we find in the Gospels and the general approach to Christmas stories and the birth of Jesus, I was going to say, it's been sanitized by the Victorians and their hymn writing, hasn't it? I think it largely has. Gentle Jesus, meek and mild, and little Lord Jesus, no crying he makes. I mean, are we really supposed to believe that? Surely not. And so you can go on. And this concept of the way it was, I don't know, it's a bit foreign, isn't it? And I think of the angel Gabriel coming to Mary. How can this be? I am a virgin, she says, and we sort of gloss through that. But just think, this was a tight Jewish community in the first century. We've got used to babies being born out of wedlock, haven't we? In our own land, particularly in the last 50 or 60 years, it's become acceptable way of doing things. I guess it was 50 times worse in Judea, a mainly Jewish community. Think of the village where they lived. We'll come to that in a while. But a tight community, Mary getting progressively more pregnant, engaged to Joseph, committed to him, betrothed, which to them was equivalent to marriage, by the way. And there she was, pregnant. And under the law, a betrothed woman who was an adulteress could be put to death by stoning. This was serious stuff. Joseph says he will divorce her, do you remember? And then the angel appears to remind him of what was really going on. You imagine that 9 months in the community where she lived, having to explain. How did she explain? We have no idea, have we really? How she explained the ever-increasing size of her body, and, you know, it was an angel and God's doing it. I mean, I can't imagine. We'd have no record of any of those things, but we can only imagine the difficulty that it brought both to Joseph and to Mary. And was that the reason that Joseph took her on the trek from Nazareth to Bethlehem, which is what, about 80 miles through Samaria? Not a very friendly territory. They could have gone the other way round, but they probably didn't. They probably went through. He didn't need to take her, actually. A male head would have done for the family census, the enrollment for taxation that took place. I mean, Caesar was just trying to find out the number of people that were around to assess the taxation that he could levy off the province. So that was why they all had to go. Did Joseph take Mary with her to enable her to have the birth in another country away from home, or just to protect her? We don't know. But anyway, that's what he did. But you come back to Mary, don't you? And I am the Lord's servant, let it be as you have said, after all that. And you think, well, the Lord's will can bring pain as well as joy, I guess. Don't we know that it brings a challenge to us very often, and difficulties sometimes on its way? But that was a difficult time, wasn't it? And then, of course, immediately after the baby was born, you remember the story of the wise men coming from the east, and Herod saying, you know, when you found the king of the Jews, let me know. You can almost hear the Uriah Heep bit coming out as he said it, can't you? I always think I can, you know. Of course, he didn't want to. This was a threat. Anything that was a threat to Herod the Great was extermination. The idea that he killed everybody in sight that I read in some books is a bit unlikely. If you just tilled the land and looked after the ground and kept your head down, I'm sure you were perfectly safe. If you were the higher up in the structure of the country you were, I guess your neck was in ever greater peril. If you were seen to be a threat by Herod the Great, then there was an issue there for you. Remember that Herod the Great died immediately after Jesus was born, and there's a danger you can read him through into the three sons, and that is not the case. Far from it, in fact. But some of the books seem to. But that wasn't right. But Herod the Great, when he heard that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, exterminated the children. There's no historical record of that anywhere else, but then there's no historical records of all sorts of stuff that took place in all sorts of times. It certainly wasn't out of character for Herod to make sure that he'd done the job. And so God spoke to Joseph, and off he went down to Egypt. He died in 4 BC. That's about the one date that you can fix fairly readily out of all those, other than the later ones, which are clearer. With modern archaeology, the dates of all those folk reigns and so on can be fixed pretty accurately. But he died in 4 BC, almost immediately afterwards. And eventually, God said to Joseph, you know, he who threatened the child is dead, you can return home. My guess is that that, and this is only a guess really, that was rather longer than we might imagine. I said that Archelaus had to troop off with the others to Rome to be granted his inheritance, and there was huge rebellion while he was away. Judea was the worst. And when he came back, the legions had to be brought down from Syria to quell the disturbances. He wasn't really established for several years, and my guess is that God probably let Jesus and the family stay in Egypt for that time. But anyway, when Joseph came back, God spoke to him again, or he felt that, I can't remember the exact story, he felt that he shouldn't go, and he moved further forward. Can we bring up the next picture then, which is the one of Judea? On we go. Yeah, that gives you, we'll move to the next, that gives you some idea of the various provinces. Philip the Tetrarch had this whole area, including, quite importantly, the other side of the Sea of Galilee. We'll come to that in a moment. There's the Sea of Galilee. Herod had Galilee and Perea and one or two other places, and Judea and Samaria were under Archelaus or the Roman procurators eventually. Galilee, there's Perea down there. Okay, move on to the next one, if you would, which takes us to Galilee, and we'll look at that in a moment. Again, the most important thing out of all this to remember is that in God's great plan, Nazareth is just over the border in another country, away from Judea, 4 or 5 miles over the border into Herod Antipas, as he was called, territory. So Jesus was in the greatest danger in Judea than anywhere else, in less danger in this area, although he kept on the move. And once he was over this side, and he spent some time in Bethsaida, Caesarea Philippi, the Decapolis, the 10 Greek cities, he ministered in all those places. Huge Gentile population in these areas, less, as we shall see in a moment, in Galilee and Judea. But it's, I think God had that great plan. It's just over the border, and he's in a separate country, vitally important part. And so you find, as you read the gospel stories, that the risk was always going up to Jerusalem, because that was where the Sanhedrin and the Jewish law prevailed in a greater way. The further you got away, the less that it all was. Right. So what was life like in Galilee? Galilee, actually, the word Galilee means a circle. So Galilee of the Gentiles, which we read somewhere, probably meant that Galilee was encircled by Gentiles. It wasn't completely, but it was pretty well. And you had Upper Galilee and Lower Galilee. This was the agricultural area where Jesus, in fact, was brought up. It's all tiny. That's what you don't realise. I've never been there. On the map, it looks bigger than it is. This whole area is only about 40 miles by 30 miles, about the same size as most of the books say of Worcestershire. So it's a teeny country. You never really have that far to go. I mean, Jerusalem's right down here, and you know, it's only 80 miles to travel right down to Jerusalem. It's a few days' journey, but it's not as far as we might think that it was. Herod Antipas, for all that is said about him, and he certainly executed John the Baptist and all of that we know. Jesus calls him that fox in one place, doesn't he? I think, if I remember rightly. He ruled pretty well. There's no evidence in any of the histories of the period of the rebellions and bloodshed and that characterized his father. Generally, it was a time of reasonable peace. Again, if you kept your head down and did your job and weren't too high up the social ladder, you probably stood a better chance of survival. But there weren't any great rebellions during his time, contrary to what we might think. So what was it like in Nazareth? There were a couple of hundred villages, it is reckoned by modern archaeology, about 150,000, 60,000 people, it is thought, lived in Galilee, scattered mainly in those 200 villages. Nazareth was tiny, perhaps 400 people. I mean, it really is an unknown place in the middle of nowhere. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? You can see why. It was absolutely tiny. Amazing, really, when you think about it. What did people do? Well, it was mainly agriculture, as we might guess from the lie of the land. Wheat, barley, vegetables, fruit, sheep, and goats. Only wealthy families would have had cattle. You guess from reading the story of the prodigal son that father was fairly wealthy in the story, had hired servants and all of that, and he killed a fatted calf, so he had cattle, but that was fairly rare. Mostly sheep and goats would have been around. There would have been a top strata in society, Herod Antipas, his followers. They'd have been a tiny percent, one perhaps, of the population. Two or three might have been judges and teachers and those sort of people in society. There would have been a number of skilled craftsmen, fishermen, leather workers, carpenters, and that sort of stuff. But 85% of the people would have worked on the land. Casual labourers, a few slaves, not that many, is thought from archaeology, not that many slaves. Beggars would have been the rest. The parable that Jesus told of the man who hired people for his vineyard, do you remember? Went down into the marketplace in the morning. The marketplace was where the unemployed collected. Unemployment was huge in the first century. Do times change? Probably not a lot. And the marketplace would be where the unemployed collected. So anybody who wanted labour would go down and find the people there. And that's what that chap does. He goes down, finds the labour, sets them to work in his vineyard. Don't forget, vineyard work was limited time during the year when you had to pick the fruit. So you'd want lots of cheap labour for the job, a temporary labour. So that would have been, and then he went down later, found some more, put them in the vineyard. You know the story probably as well as I do. And then he gave them all a denarius. A denarius was Roman coin. It was a day's pay for a day's work. It was at pretty much subsistence level. It kept you, and that was about all. So unemployment was rife. The fear of unemployment and what it did for your family, no health insurance or anything like that, of course, in the first century. And there was this sort of temporary employment that went on. You were probably better off if you were the prodigal son. Do you remember when he decided to come back to his father? He said, let me be as one of your hired servants, because they were better off than anybody. If you worked on a big estate, you had some continuity of employment, food, provision, probably for your family. You might have had somewhere to live, like a tired cottage today, in today's terms. So no wonder the prodigal thought, well, if I can't come back as a son, hired servant wouldn't be too bad, if I may put it that way. Needless to say, he came back as a son, as we know, but that gives you some of the sort of flavour and background that you could see there. Jesus was, of course, a carpenter, or was he? Tekton, Mark chapter 6 and verse 3, was a carpenter, but you could have been a mason or a builder with that word tekton. There wasn't too much wood around. So Jesus undoubtedly would not have spent all his time doing carpentry. He'd have been a minor house repairer, could have even built them. No doubt there was some woodwork and furnishings, but it would have been house building and repairs probably that Joseph, the head of the family business as it were, and then Jesus going on from that. Did Jesus move to Nazareth? Because Sepphoris is about 4 miles to the north. Sepphoris, no one had ever heard of it until about 25 years ago, was the capital city being built by Herod, Antipas himself, starting as soon as he was established. So when Jesus was there as a young man, Sepphoris was a Greekish type city, and there would have been lots of work there. Did Joseph go there because of that? Probably not, but it was certainly useful to be there. Did Jesus in his teens and later on work in Sepphoris? We don't know. Did Jesus travel and meet people in the course of his work? Probably. It could explain in Jesus' ministry, and this is only a theory, why Jesus was so often at home with wealthy people. He did meet wealthy people, went to banquets. The rich put on banquets. He had some wealthy followers that we read about in the Gospels. It's interesting to speculate, did Jesus meet any of them when he was a working man on his travels? Well, that's pure speculation, so you can throw all that away if you want to. But it does at least fit a scenario. He did seem relaxed in the company of maybe a different social strata than he might have been used to, which I think is quite interesting. And of course, fishing was a big issue. I mean, four of Jesus' disciples we know were fishermen. You can speculate from John 21 that a couple of the others might have been. Philip came from Bethsaida, on the other side of the lake, by the way, in Philip's territory. So the journey across the lake actually wasn't that far, which accounts for the reason why in John's Gospel, you remember when John 6, isn't it, when Jesus is trooping back and forth across the lake, the crowds go around the road and they're not far behind, and that's because they weren't far behind. The distance across the sea wasn't a lot of difference. The disciples got caught up in the storm, you remember, and Jesus walked on the water. And when the crowd got there, they said, how did you get there, Jesus? There was only one boat. He didn't bother to answer that question. Didn't tell them he'd walked on the water, but it's not that far to walk round. And Jesus did a lot of his ministry in this area, which I think is something we need to bear in mind. The lake, of course, is quite small. Once you realise the whole of Galilee is so tiny, it's only 13 miles long at its absolute length and 8 miles wide at the very widest point. And there were at least 16 or 20 villages around the side of the shore, and the fishing business was huge, and a lot of the fish was salted and a delicacy. Some of it got to Rome, believe it or not. There was a big import and export trade that went on at that time, because borders were open, trade was open as well. And of course there was talk years ago that the famous trade routes that came up, the Tigris and Euphrates, would have come down there. Well, they probably did, but the thought is they probably missed Galilee, although some routes possibly went through, and certainly there'd have been a lot of trade. There's evidence from archaeology, most of which has been done in the last 20 years. The Israel Archaeological Society, they don't call themselves that, they've got some slightly posher name. They've been excavating massively in the last few years in Sepphoris since 1983. And the place is not currently inhabited, so excavation has gone on well there. And clearly it was a city, not very big, probably only 8,000 or 10,000. I mean, no bigger than Chard before it expanded itself, really, in recent times. It was, we'd hardly call it a city. It was a city by comparison with the tiny villages that were around. There were some multi-story buildings. What is interesting is that the excavations that have been done, and they say a huge amount has been done since the 1980s, what they reveal is that the country was primarily Jewish still. Now, we probably believe that anyway. When I was younger, the general belief was, you know, Israel, Palestine, Jewish. And then scholarly writing moved further out and probably moved through the middle of the pendulum and out the other side and started to say, well, yeah, but there were lots of Gentiles around and the trade routes went through and blah, blah, blah. And we've sort of, the pendulum as a result of the archaeology has swung back a bit. It reveals largely Jewish homes, the utensils that Jews would have used for ritual cleansing, dietary habits, no pig bones, for example, all this type of stuff. Burial habits of the Jews were different from the Gentiles, and so the area was still very strongly Jewish. So what about Sepphoris? Well, that seems to be largely Jewish. There may have been a theatre, although some doubt whether that was there in New Testament times, to be honest, but it was basically inhabited by Herod and his clique and friends, but it was still Jewish. They were all Jewish people who lived there. They liked a few Greek luxuries, maybe, but they were basically Jewish. And it's interesting, in the Gospels, there's only one recorded instance of Jesus speaking to a Gentile, actually in Galilee, and that was in Matthew 8, where he speaks to a centurion, a Capernaum. He wouldn't have been a Roman centurion, by the way. He'd have been an auxiliary that Herod would have raised. But nevertheless, a centurion in charge of 100 soldiers, nonetheless. But Jesus would have met endless Gentiles around all these other places, particularly this side, when it would have been largely Gentile, and any excursion into these other areas, he'd have met more Gentiles there than Jews. So, what about Greek influence? Because it's a big question. How far did the influence of Greece, Hellenization they call it, how far did that really creep into the Jewish way of life? Well, Greek culture was there. When the Romans came, they were happy to leave Greek culture as it was. They were happy to leave Greek as the English of the ancient world, the language that everybody spoke. So if you went to Rome in the first century, what language would you hear being spoken in Rome? No, it wouldn't have been Latin. Undoubtedly, it would have been Greek most of the time. Latin would have been the legal language and language spoken amongst Romans themselves, perhaps, but everybody knew Greek. So everybody spoke Greek. So that begs a question, really. And it used to be 100 years ago, the critical scholarship of the period would have said the disciples couldn't have written the Gospels because they wouldn't have known any Greek. Of course they knew Greek. All these people spoke Greek. Matthew, at his customs booth, which would have his taxation would have been customs tax, probably, a sort of VAT on everything that passed by. He'd have had to have spoken and written Greek. Undoubtedly, the disciples did speak Greek, particularly as most of them hailed from around here, where the Gentile influence on the Lake of Galilee was quite strong. Did Jesus teach sometime in Greek? We don't know the answer to that. No reason why he shouldn't. There are some Aramaicisms, if that's the word, in the Gospels that are well known to us. And clearly he spoke Aramaic. But do we assume that when he excursed into some of these areas, where there would have been a large number of Gentiles, do we assume that he only spoke the local language, or did he speak Greek? Do we assume that even to the Jews that he might have met in Galilee, it was quite common for the Jews of the empire, there were 2 million Jews roughly living in this area in New Testament times, and they reckon another 6 were scattered around the dispersion, interestingly, 3 times as many. Jews often came home when they got older, wanting to die in the Holy Land. Some of them wouldn't have spoken Aramaic at all. So what would Jesus do then? He may well have taught in Greek at different times. We don't know. The New Testament doesn't tell us. I think it highly probable, and there would have certainly been some occasions when he was in mainly Gentile territory, when they certainly would not have known Aramaic. Aramaic was a rather ancient, funny language, actually. It would not have been widely known outside. And many of the Jews coming from outside certainly wouldn't have spoken it. They might have spoken their own local lingo, wherever that was, and Greek. So, you know, that would have been the thing. And it's interesting, isn't it, that in a country where Aramaic was spoken, the biblical language for most of them was Greek. Greek had already translated the Hebrew scriptures 2 centuries before Christ, the Septuagint, as we know. Incidentally, when the Greeks in Alexandria wanted to translate the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek, they sent up to Jerusalem for some Greek scholars to go and help them. Interesting, isn't it? Greek scholars 2 centuries before Christ in Jerusalem. And so the Bible language was Greek, and the spoken language. And interestingly, excavations that have been dug up in Galilee, more than 50% of them, where there's writing, are in Greek, not Aramaic. Very interesting. And of course, a number of the disciples have got Greek names, by the way, not biblical names. And what is also interesting they've been discovering is that clearly most of those in Galilee could speak Greek better than they could write it, because some of the inscriptions and some of the writing on papyrus that's been dug up is appalling, and the grammar's terrible. So clearly they could speak it better than they could write it. And you get a little evidence of that, not hugely so, even in the New Testament, where some of the writers are less polished in their use of Greek than some of the others. So that would hang together with Jesus and the disciples, all having at least a working knowledge of speaking Greek, even if they didn't write it that particularly well. And of course, the inscription on the cross was written in Greek, Latin, and Aramaic. Waste of time if no one could read any of it, if you think about it. So that's something to be borne in mind as well. Jesus, of course, knew all about cities. It's often said he didn't visit. There's no evidence that he visited Sepphoris ever, or Tiberias, which was the second city that Herod started to build, named after the next emperor, Tiberius. No evidence that Jesus ever went there. He preferred the countryside to the cities, did he? It's an argument from silence, because there must be lots of places that Jesus, we don't have a record that Jesus ever visited, but it may have a point. He probably did. Maybe, and there is some evidence that once Herod Antipas had disposed of John the Baptist, Jesus went to a place away for a while, it says in the Gospels. And he certainly kept on the move after that, realizing they had to keep moving round. So maybe to go to the big cities was to invite trouble. So he stayed away and kept on the move and continually went in and out of these territories. So maybe that's got something to do with it. But he certainly knew about cities. A lot of his teaching talks about banks, talks about law courts and markets. He knew what went on in cities. So maybe, as we said earlier, he'd perhaps been to them. So that was what life was like. It would be nice to think that the prosperity that came to Galilee in these 20 or 30 years was shared around. But needless to say, the rich got richer. And guess what? The poor got poorer. Does this have a modern ring about it? I suspect that it probably does. That's because human nature hasn't changed down the centuries. And so much of what Jesus said does have a hugely relevant bearing, without much application indeed, on our own times. Of course, when Jesus went to Judea and down to Jerusalem, the situation was greatly changed. Now, Judea was a third-rate province, governed directly from Rome by Roman governors. Pontius Pilate, minor and most undesirable province, was considered to Judea. It was the poison chalice of the Roman Empire. If you were out of favour, they gave you Judea to be governor of. You were sure to get into trouble. There was no way you could escape it. And so Pontius Pilate was pretty dreadful. Was he the worst of the procurators or prefects? Possibly not. Some of the later ones were probably even worse. But the Sanhedrin had a big say. Rome had been generous. Despite what you might think, Rome was generous to the Jewish people. Julius Caesar got on well with the Jews and with the first Herod. He had already decreed that the Jews could have a variety of benefits. They didn't have to serve in the legions. They were exempt from military service. As we said already, Roman standards couldn't be carried into Jerusalem. Generally speaking, their sensibilities about one God and no pagan gods were generally respected wherever they were. They were allowed to build their own synagogues in any part of the Roman Empire. Occasionally they got a bit strong and dictated the pace a bit and dominated. We read later on, it doesn't come into our thing, that Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome for a spell. But they were allowed these tremendous freedoms that it's easy to forget. And the Sanhedrin in Judea were allowed under Rome to rule. And you get that from the trial of Jesus pretty much. They had pretty much the say in what goes on. They had to do what the Roman governor said, and there was this tension, but broadly they were allowed and had a fair share of rule, providing they kept the peace and so on. Pilate was certainly anti-Semitic. That is a question we haven't addressed this evening at all. Were the rest of the Romans anti-Semitic? Depends what you mean, I guess. There were those who were violently so, of which Pilate certainly was. He did everything to antagonise everybody, and that's why he eventually got the boot and was exiled, because it had already been decreed that the Jews would have these benefits. And whilst the Caesar family were in reign, right up to 70, 66, that more or less held true for them. They were a recognised legal religion in the Roman Empire, and they didn't have to sacrifice to the emperor. They sacrificed for the emperor, not to him. There's a difference. We might pray for someone, but we're not going to pray to them. That was a subtle difference. So they would offer sacrifice for the emperor, but they didn't worship him in any way. They were allowed not to. Of all the places, of all the people in the Roman Empire, the Jews were allowed not to worship Caesar, and the early Caesars were already declared to be gods. So they had an enormous number of advantages. That didn't stop them from rebelling at different times, and that mostly comes later on. There was a huge Jewish colony in Alexandria, and two of the quarters of the city, they were actually allowed to have their own little Sanhedrins to rule. Quite extraordinary. So the favours granted to the Jews were enormous compared to other peoples. Of course, when you get to the trial of Jesus, the Sanhedrin could legally pass sentence on Jesus, but could not legally execute him. Pontius Pilate could only do that. A lot is said about Herod being there, but remember, Herod had no jurisdiction. He was the ruler of the country next door, Galilee. He was up there for the feast, as every good Jew was. He had no real say. Some of the books major on, you know, Herod and Pilate didn't get on and all this stuff. Well, they probably didn't, but the Gospels don't tell us that. And in any event, Pilate had the say. He was all for letting Jesus off, as we know. Interesting. When you get to the cross, of course, the title was King of the Jews, wasn't it? So he was executed under the Romans as a political criminal. In a sense, it was high treason. The Romans hated kings. They were originally a kingdom. But in 500 and something, they booted out the last king and declared a republic. And that carried on right the way through. So any mention of a king, and you remember Caiaphas at the trial of Jesus, you know, we have no king but Caesar. You can nearly hear him doing his Uriah Heep bit, because he didn't believe it for a second, really. They connived with the Roman authorities. The high priesthood was bought and sold under the Roman empires. It was the procurator or prefect's way of making money. So from 6 AD right through to 66 AD, the high priesthood was in one family with the exception of 4 years. And that was Caiaphas and Annas and Ananias. Caiaphas was high priest himself for about 12 years, and the family dominated because they could afford to buy it. And so the backhander for the Roman prefect was buying and selling the high priesthood. And the Jews hated it, of course. The Pharisees absolutely loathed it. And you had all these sections within the Sanhedrin who actually ruled. So it was a difficult time for them. Right, I'm going to conclude in 1 minute. At Chard, we started reading this book, Philip Yancey, The Jesus I Never Knew, and it's quite interesting. We have a book club. Is that the way to put it? Perhaps that's the wrong word. It's interesting. The first couple of chapters do touch on some of these things, and of course, being as I've been reading it, you read stuff like this. Here's one bit. Scarcely a day passed, in fact, without an execution under Herod's regime. Well, I don't doubt it was true. Crucifixion was the way of punishing everybody. The political climate at the time of Jesus' birth resembled that of Russia in the 1930s under Stalin. No, it didn't. The citizens could not gather in public meetings. Oh, yes, they could. They gathered in their synagogues. See, you think, not really true. The cruelest and most notorious of these governors was a man named Pontius Pilate. Well connected, Pilate had married the granddaughter of Augustus himself. Well, I tell you what, if he was well connected, he wasn't well connected enough, was he? Because it was the worst province to be sent to. So it didn't make much difference, him being well connected. So I questioned that one, I have to say. And here's the one I love best of all in the book. As I got to know Jesus, the realization sank in that he probably did not spend his life among Jews in the first century merely to save Americans in the 20th. And I thought, true, no. He spent his life among Jews in the first century to save them and everybody in between, and Americans in the first century and us. So I didn't like much of that. Of all people in history, this gets worse, believe me, he had the privilege of choosing where and when to be born. And he chose a pious Jewish family living in a backwater protectorate of a pagan empire. Well, he may have been able to choose the time, but he certainly couldn't choose the people he was born to, because he was coming to God's chosen people already. And he couldn't have been born amongst the 6 million Jews scattered around the empire. There would have been no centralness about it. He basically had to be born in Jewish territory, didn't he? Judea or Galilee or somewhere around, to fulfill the prophecies, apart from anything else, that were already written in the Old Testament. So I wrote that one off as well, I have to say. So there you are, a little bit of knowledge. You can test what you read as well. We've overshot a little bit, folks, but I'm happy to take a question or two. Probably 5 or 6. I mean, you'd have to allow a year, Herod did. So you're coming back to 5 or 6. Some would say 7, but probably 5 or 6, yes. And we know that he started his ministry in the 14th year, wasn't it, of Tiberius. Well, we know that Tiberius followed Caesar Augustus. He died in August, conveniently his own named month, by the way. Did you realise that? August is Augustus. He renamed the month of the Roman calendar. July is Julius. Julius Caesar, if you didn't know. The various other months got renamed. So October, November and December were as they were. Dec being the 10th month. You all say, wait a minute, it's the 12th month. And I'll tell you that the Roman calendar began on the 1st of March. So as far as they were concerned, yeah, it is the 10th month. And so it goes on. But those months got renamed. Interesting, isn't it? But he died in August AD 14. So the 14th year or 15th year, is it? You're up to about 28, 29 when Jesus began his ministry. So probably the 3 years, crucifixion 31, 32. You can throw a year either way around that, can't you, depending on how you interpret it. So Jesus might have been a little bit older than we tended to think. He could have been in the late 30s rather than the early 30s when you creep back from naught AD. To be fair, we haven't thought it was naught AD for a long time. Remember, the calendar, as we know it, wasn't formulated until 300 or 400 AD, and by that time, chronology wasn't as good as it is today. Today, they can work back and even tell you when the Passover was in each of the years that Jesus might have been crucified in, because all the way we can work back things back today, which they didn't have access to in those days. So our chronology is hugely more accurate, and you can pinpoint things with a degree of accuracy that they couldn't do in 300 or 400. So that accounts for the error of a few years, which wouldn't have bothered them in those days. Sorry, was I answering a question? Can't even remember. Did I answer it? Good, okay. You can ramble on the subject and then forget what the question was. But the key points to remember are and it affects so much in the later, the 80 years of freedom. They never got it out of their blood. They wanted their freedom, hence the rebellions that take place after all this. That the country was three different countries. That so undergirds Jesus' ministry as he went around. And you could hear it from the disciples. Are you going up to Jerusalem? That was the hothouse. I mean, we knew that, I think, but you can see why once you realize it was a different country, a different ruler, and the Sanhedrin had particular sway, even though it was Jewish occupation, Roman occupation. The Jewish leaders and the high priests had a big say in what went on. But once you got over the border, blow me, things were a bit different. So that's another important thing to remember. They're the vital things, I think. They affect our understanding so much. Okay.
When was Aramaic spoken then, mainly?
Mainly in... It's a similar language to others that are scattered around the area of that time, but wouldn't have been widely spoken. It was an old language and similar to others of its type, but wouldn't have been widely spoken anywhere else. He could have done, but equally, when he went into mainly Gentile territories, it's hard to believe that he spoke Aramaic. And when you think he addressed the crowds, a big crowd, like in John 6 when they were over the other side, at Bethsaida, would Aramaic have been appropriate? Probably not. If he had enough Greek speaking it. Don't forget, vocabulary wouldn't have necessarily had to be that large. Most of Jesus' illustrations were homely, out of daily life. You know, vocabulary would be limited. I mean, I heard recently from somebody that, and I never did Hebrew, but apparently biblical Hebrew was a very limited language. And that's why it's, you know, you get, when you read your Old Testament, you get a note that says, bottom of the page, and you get endless different possibilities. Some of that isn't because the words are different in the original Hebrew text. They probably aren't. Hebrew was well transmitted, much better than the Greek of the New Testament. The Jewish scribes were very careful. It was probably because the word had about five different meanings. I'm serious, because the vocabulary was so limited, and it was the context that determined it. And sometimes, even in wherever you're reading the Old Testament, it's not quite clear what the context might be. You might rule out three of the possible six translations, but you're left with the other three. That sometimes, it's interesting. And that someone told me that. It came up in passing from someone who knew Hebrew, and it transformed my thinking suddenly about the Old Testament. It was only about 6 months ago. Quite extraordinary. He had probably gone to Greek, but the language wouldn't have been huge for him. He could have well covered with fairly limited Greek, actually. The Hebrew language, I think the language had transformed itself. I'm guessing so. My background on this is not that good. And of course, all that was wiped out in AD 70 when the town was razed to the ground. It was eventually inhabited by Gentiles, and Jews weren't allowed to go there. I mean, the Romans had had enough of the Jewish people. Not entirely without cause. That's another story if you want to invite me again. But, that's another issue completely. But they were, you know, the Jews were scattered. And indeed, for 2,000 years only, well, you know, the story in our own day has changed that, 48 and all that stuff. Yeah. I'm guessing so. I'm not an expert on that. I wouldn't hazard an answer. They would have used Hebrew. Yes. Oh, yes. And Jesus would have been proficient. He asked for the scroll. Well, he'd have had to ask for which scroll. It would have probably been on three. I mean, Isaiah's so big, it would be on three scrolls at least. So he knew which one to ask. And 32-foot scroll, it took some effort to find it, as we discussed once before. I mean, you'd be forever finding the text, unless you knew your Hebrew jolly well. So, yes, he'd have been very proficient in Hebrew, as would all Jewish boys. have been. I mean, I read somewhere they're supposed to learn it off by heart, weren't they? The Old Testament. I find that hard to believe, but they would have known it very thoroughly. Let's put it like that. Tried. It is interesting, though, and we get to this next time, if there is a next time, but that the very much that the language of the New Testament church was Greek, of course, even the Old Testament scriptures. I mean, Paul always quotes from the Greek Old Testament, even to mixed Jewish and Gentile congregations. It's interesting. Shall I pray?
Yes.
Yeah. Father, we just thank you for archaeology and the research that's particularly become available to us in the last 30 years. We could have guessed at some of this maybe 50 years ago, but certainly so much of what the country would have been like when Jesus was there has come alive for us because of the work done in Israel and continues to be done in recent times, and for the wealth of manuscript and inscription from all over the Far East that we've been able to dig up so helped us to our biblical understanding, and we do thank you for that. Father, we pray that you will enable some of the thoughts of today to bless our understanding as we read the Gospel accounts and the New Testament generally in our own private times of devotion. So we thank you for our time together today. In Jesus' name, Amen.